MechCast, Thursday, July 28th, 2016. Hey, MechGeeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for MechGeeks by MechGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I am back from my travels. You might be able to tell that I'm back on the home studio rig. Actually, I'm in here in the warm closet studio here at MechCast headquarters. It's a little bit warm lately. It's been nice summer nights, but you know, or summer days rather, but you know, it can get a little warm in the old 6x6 studio here. So we're going to do our best to get through this, not sweat it out too much. We do have a number of great stories to get to. We have Apple's third quarter earnings call that happened this week. Some good numbers from there. A little bit of a mixed bag, I guess. And we'll get into that. Rumors around Apple Car, what Apple is doing in the television space. We're going to talk more about the iPhone headphone jack. Yeah, I know, but there's some good stuff to talk about in there. Also, the elephant in the room we will get to, and you won't be surprised when I say what that is. Apple's got some new watch straps and some updates on some new Macs and USB-C. We've got all of that. And a couple of questions, a question about archiving iMovie projects. We're going to talk a little bit about iTunes and music app. And then I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. So lots of stuff to get to. But before we get into all of that, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors. And that is iMazing. Actually, I love iMazing. It is a tool that I've used on many occasions to help me out with my iOS devices, specifically backing up data, restoring data. I've even used it for a little light Minecraft pocket hacking, loading some levels onto Minecraft from my computer. It's a great tool for that. And what iMazing is, in case you don't know what it is a tool that lets you access, view, backup, and manage the data on your iOS devices directly. So while iTunes will let you do that for some of the data, iMazing actually lets you get in there and look at everything. And best of all, there's no jailbreaking required. So there's not anything special. Well, there's some special stuff going on here. I guess I shouldn't say that. But there isn't anything out of the ordinary. You don't have to, you know, mess with your devices to get this to work. And what iMazing allows you to do is manage and interact with data from messages, photos and videos, your music app, notes, contacts, voicemail, call history, file system, backups. You can get into all of it. And it's got a great, very familiar Apple-like interface. It's, you know, that traditional three-pane interface. It works fast and asynchronously. So actually, as you're doing, say, a backup task, maybe you want to back up your voicemails, you can be working and browsing on other files and looking at other things, maybe your call history or taking a look at your notes. And it will even access and browse files from inside your backups. And so that's great, like I said, for recovering data from apps that maybe you had to reinstall that don't sync up to the cloud. We have a lot of those apps. I dread often doing the, you know, erase and setup as new fix when I run into an issue with my iOS devices. But iMazing makes that less painful because I know I can go in, I can get at my data, and I can put it back into my apps once I've reinstalled them. It'll let you export and re-import that saved data. And again, you can back up, say, things like your messages, your voicemails, so you can reclaim space off your device. Maybe you want to save those. I know a lot of people who like to save every voicemail message, but you don't have to leave those on your device. You can use iMazing to pull those off and then free up space on your device. And best of all, you can try it completely free. And when you order the app, you'll get 20% off your order if you use the coupon code MACCAST. So just go to iMazing.com, and when you order, use the code MACCAST. You'll get 20% off. A great app. Check it out. Again, you can try it for free if you just want to take a look and see if it's something you might be able to use, but I think you're really going to like it. So big thank you to iMazing for their support of the MACCAST. Let's dive right into Apple's third quarter earnings call. They had a okay third quarter when it came to the dollars, but when you look at the product and the unit numbers, those continue to slump pretty much across the board. wasn't anything unexpected, and actually Wall Street reacted pretty positively. As far as how the numbers go, they had net profits of $7.8 billion on revenues of $42.4 billion. That's profit down 27% from the year-ago quarter and revenue down 14.6%. So sounds pretty negative, but again, Wall Street analysts, Apple beat their expectations, so it had a net positive effect actually on Apple's stock price. If you've been paying attention to that, you probably noticed it. Breaking things down, they said that they sold 40.4 million iPhones in the quarter. That's down 15% in terms of units, 23% in terms of revenue. They were optimistic, though, about the iPhone SE bringing in new iPhone customers that will eventually turn into iPhone upgraders and maybe add into some of other Apple's other products and services. But here's the thing. With that model, it has a lower average selling price. So it's probably a big reason why, you know, iPhones did pretty well, but revenues were down 23%. You know, you're selling phones that cost a little bit less. You get a little less profit in there. And that is the net result. But good news is, in this quarter, Apple shipped its 1 billionth iPhone with a B. So there are a billion iPhones out there now. And that is a pretty amazing milestone. Moving on to iPad, unit sales of iPads were down only 9% this quarter. We've been seeing larger declines than that. Apple sold 9.95 million iPads, so just under 10 million. Revenue, however, was up 7%, and you can probably guess why. Yeah, it's that iPad Pro. The iPad Pro had a large appeal. Apple sold a lot more of those, and again, kind of the opposite effect of the iPhone SE. Having a higher average selling price meant more profit for Apple. So even though they're still seeing declining iPad sales in terms of units quarter over quarter, year over year, profits coming up a little bit with the help of the iPad Pro. Now, will that continue into the next quarter? Probably not. I wouldn't expect it to. But again, it's good that Apple's selling iPads that are generating a little bit more revenue as, you know, things slow down a little bit. Moving on to Macs. Macs were also down 11% in terms of unit sales, 13% in terms of revenue. But Apple still did see a small quarter over quarter increase in Mac sales, up from 4 million last quarter to 4.2 million this quarter. So the 11%, 13%, down 11% in unit sales and down 13% in revenue, that's year over year. Apple has also not really had any new models in a while, so I think that probably contributed to the lower numbers for the Mac. We are expected to get some upgrades here soon, but so far we've only seen, at least this year, a MacBook upgrade, a CPU update in April, if you remember that. But you know, look at things like the Mac Pro. That's approaching 1,000 days without an update. Yeah, that thing's pretty long in the tooth. Way overdue for an update on the Mac Pro. And we are expecting those new MacBook Pros sometime soon, the ones we've heard about with the OLED touchscreen function bar, which will be really cool and I think would drive Mac sales probably in the next quarter, although they're going to be coming toward the end of the quarter, so it may be more in the holiday quarter where we see that bump. Services, once again, was the big hero of growth for Apple. They saw a 19% increase in revenue, up to $5.98 billion from $5.03 billion a year ago. And services are now generating, get this, $2 billion more in revenue than Mac sales are currently. So services have now surpassed Apple's Mac sales in terms of the product breakup. As a matter of fact, services is the number two revenue generator for Apple at this point, followed by, I think, iPads and then Macs in terms of revenue. And then, of course, we have Apple's other products and services. That includes things like the Apple TV, the iPod, the Apple Watch, and Beats headphones. That part of the company made $2.2 billion in the quarter. That was a 16% decline in revenue. So overall, again, numbers down, Apple's seeing this kind of slowing across the product lines, but Wall Street still pretty happy because they beat the estimates. A few other highlights from the call were Apple Pay. Apple Pay's monthly users is now up over 400% year over year, so Apple adding a lot more Apple Pay users. Apple claims that retailers are telling them that three out of four contactless payments made in the U.S. are being made with Apple Pay. Along with the bump in services, App Store revenue was up 37%, so definitely contributing to that. Apple selling a lot of apps. iPhone sales in India were also up 51% year over year, at least in the first three quarters of this year. So that's good growth in India, another good emerging market for iPhone sales. Apple now has $231.5 billion in cash and marketable securities. So their war chest, the cash on hand continues to grow. And that's overall a good thing. Another thing that I didn't find too surprising but is interesting is that Apple spent $7.475 billion on R&D in the quarter. That's up from $5.87 billion in the same quarter a year ago. And R&D spending is now accounting for about 6% of Apple's total revenue, which is the highest R&D spend to revenue ratio that we've ever seen for Apple. So Apple definitely looking into and investigating new technologies. We know we've got things like the Apple Car, Apple looking into VR and AR technologies, developing more of their chip technologies. So I think they're spending money in the right place, right? They're focusing on emerging technologies and sort of what's coming next. And Tim Cook even commented that Apple is keeping an eye on augmented reality because he was questioned in the Q&A, of course, about Pokemon Go, but more on that a little bit later. Few things to think about, services being that second largest source of revenue growth behind iPhone. I think that's an area that Apple is going to want to continue to grow. You know that Apple Music is contributing to that, at least on some level. The growth of the App Store revenue is also contributing to that. So expect Apple to kind of branch out and I think really push more services into the mix of what's going on within the company. What they're going to do, I think a lot of us have our bets on something in the TV space. And actually, Tim Cook made some comments on that. We're going to talk a little bit more about TV here in a minute. Another interesting thing is that iPhone generates at least four times more revenue than any other of Apple's product categories. So iPhone is still a large chunk of their revenue, even though those sales are declining, which kind of makes it easy to understand why Wall Street is really nervous about slowing iPhone sales and not really seeing what Apple's future products are going to be, you know, what that next area of really big growth for Apple is. I mean, the services growth is nice to see, but that's really not something that Apple is going to build, you know, the next generation, the next 10 years of the company on. They're going to need something bigger. You know, is that going to be Apple Car? Is that going to be something in the VR space, the augmented reality space? We really don't know. But that sort of sums up Apple's quarterly results. Again, you know, good, okay, not great. Moving on to Apple Car, we've got a lot of rumors surrounding Apple Car this week. Three brothers who worked on Apple's car project have supposedly revealed that the launch date might slip to 2021. Originally, there had been some rumors that Apple would have a car project ready to go or a car out on the market, say, by 2020. The information came from actually an article on a site called The Information. It's behind a paywall, but I think 9to5 Mac kind of broke the story. And if you remember, even Elon Musk said that if Apple can't get a car into the market until 2020, that might even still be too late. Again, he was specifically referring to an electric car. But as you know, if you've been following the rumors, Apple might not just be working on just an electric car. There's kind of a lot of speculation about what they might be up to. And an interesting thing happened this week. Apple pulled in Bob Mansfield, pulled him out of retirement to sort of head up Project Titan, at least according, again, to the rumors. This is according to a report at the Wall Street Journal. Bob Mansfield, as you may remember, was Apple's VP of hardware. He ran the hardware team for a long time. And then when he was getting ready to retire, he was moved into special projects. Then he retired and has since been kind of acting as an advisor to Apple. Now they're pulling him back in. If you remember also a while back, as far as the car project goes, the rumored former lead of that project, Steve Zdebski left Apple amid reports that the project was having some internal issues due to challenges like unattainable deadlines or timelines and all the organizational changes that it was going through. So it's looking like they're bringing in Mansfield to kind of shape up that team, kind of give it some direction. And that direction may be changing a little bit because Bloomberg is reporting that Mansfield has taken the lead for the car strategy and shifted it towards autonomous driving. So he supposedly hired an operating system expert and former QNX developer, that's the BlackBerry company that does their in-car systems, Dan Dodge, to work on the autonomous driving software for the Apple Car project. QNX developed infotainment driver assistance systems for companies like Ford, Volkswagen, and others. So they definitely have the chops, or Dan would definitely have the chops to kind of lead up that effort. So they say that Apple is taking on a two-pronged approach, that they're going to use hardware and software together to get the project done. That really wasn't that surprising. Just like every other project that Apple does, it's all about the integration of the hardware and software. This is what Apple is really good at. And so it makes sense that that's the kind of discipline or the kind of approach they're going to bring to designing a car. So, you know, they are designing and building a car hardware to go along with an integrated software system to power it. And they're breaking up the team. Supposedly Mansfield is actually working with three teams. He has a software team. He has a sensor team, which is going to be critical for an autonomous vehicle. And if you remember all those rumors about the acquisitions and things Apple has done in that space in terms of picking up engineers, talent, as well as companies related to sensor technologies. And then, of course, you have a hardware engineering team that would be responsible for actually building a vehicle. Now, does that mean Apple is actually going to put a vehicle on the road? Not necessarily. They could be just developing a system, developing prototype vehicles to work with, working with sensors, and it could ultimately be something they end up partnering with someone. It's way too early to tell. I mean, this is a huge R&D project for Apple at this point, but I think if you look at what they've been doing, taking guys like Mansfield, pulling him out of retirement, putting him in charge of this project, they're getting pretty serious about this kind of being the next big thing. And when you think about it, it kind of makes sense. Now, the other thing you have to think about is, you know, what is Apple's motivation for doing any product? And it's not to be to necessarily be the first to market. So I think there's going to be a number of we already know there's a number of electric vehicles out there right now. That's going to continue to expand. Apple's not going to be the first company to put an electric vehicle on the market, obviously, at this point. And 2020, 2021 would be really late to be doing that. I think that is a clear sign that that's not just what they're going to do. And then you might turn to autonomous vehicles. Well, you look at what Google's doing, what Tesla's doing. There's a number of companies that sort of have advancements. They're going to get to market first with those kinds of products. So they're going to beat Apple as well. So what is Apple up to? What are they playing around with? And I think you have to ask yourself the question, where is Apple going to be able to disrupt the market the most? And, you know, the automotive industry, I think, is ripe for disruption. But you're not going to disrupt it by putting out an electric car. Or you're probably not even going to disrupt it by putting out an autonomous vehicle. What you really need to look at is the whole picture of what Apple's messing around with. So there's three potential areas: electric cars, self-driving cars, and ride-sharing services. They're all shifting in the landscape right now. And I would throw in with ride-sharing services also car-sharing services, which we haven't seen too much of, but they're starting to emerge. And I'm beginning to think that what Apple is really interested in doing and is really looking at seriously is cars as a service. And if you think about it, they invested this $1 billion investment in Didi Chung, a ride-sharing service in China. And I think a big part of doing that was to kind of get insight and perspective on how Chinese people move around in their vehicles. You remember, the U.S., and this is hard for U.S. people to really come to grips with, in the U.S., we're car obsessed. We all have cars. Everybody drives themselves everywhere. But, you know, the rest of the world is not really like that. There's a big part of the rest of the world where people either don't drive at all, they use public transportation, they use other forms of getting around. Now, imagine a fleet of vehicles, electric vehicles, self-driving cars that you rent or lease time in, almost like, you know, you rent and lease storage space on a cloud service. That could be the kind of thing that Apple is looking into. And I haven't heard too many people talking about this, but I've just started to think about it. So this is pure speculation on my part, just thinking about this. But that would be something totally disruptive. Looking at the future of transportation, how we people are going to get around, you know, imagine being able to have your smartphone or your watch and instantly be able to call up a vehicle when you need it, use it for just the amount of time you need to use it, and then it just drives away and goes off to service another person. That could be the kind of thing that Apple is looking at. And it might be something they roll out in a market like China first, you know, where you have a lot of people that need to get around from place to place, but don't necessarily want to invest in a car. Maybe they don't even have the money to invest in a car. So it's really interesting to think about. And Apple's all about the experience. So going on along with that kind of service is not just the vehicle itself and just not just the autonomous system, but there's the whole service of, you know, an experience of how do I get the car? How do I make sure one's available when I need it? How do I do all of these things, all these logistics? And I think Apple is going to nail that experience. And they're really looking at what transportation will look like 10 years from now, 15 years from now. And that is the place that they're skating to. You know, they always talked about, you know, that classic, I think it's a Wayne, I want to say it's a Wayne Gretzky quote, but I'm not very up on my hockey trivia. But, you know, skating to where the puck is going to be, not where, you know, it is at the moment or where it's, you know, where it's going. You skate to where it's going to, basically. And I think that's what Apple is up to with their car project. All right, moving on to television. You know, Apple is moving into television. They've been very tentative about it. But Apple TV is starting to become a thing. And actually, in this latest quarterly results call, Tim Cook reaffirmed and re-said that Apple really sees Apple TV as a foundation for, quote, what they believe can be a broader business over time. And I think this plays right into their services growth. You know, one thought, of course, is that Apple TV is going to add some sort of subscription package. We've been hearing Apple's been working on this for a long time. But this week, we're starting to hear, you know, that still is really stalled. Those talks are not going well for very well for Apple, because Apple is taking a really hard stance on that whole skinny bundle, on the content, and content owners are not really happy with Apple, including, actually, this report this week came out of, you know, someone talking to Disney executives saying, you know, we're not making headway with Apple. They're demanding too many things when it comes to getting this content. The key issue seems to be that Apple is demanding multi-year lock-in periods on the monthly rates per viewer, which is not something that the content providers are typically used to doing. They're used to having maybe a yearly contract with provisions so that they can up the monthly rates per viewer as they need to kind of continue revenue growth. Apple's not into that. They want to lock in longer terms, and the cable companies are not having it. Or not the cable companies, the content providers, rather, are not having any of it. So the service that Apple wants to get to put together would reportedly have both live channels and an on-demand library of content, but I wouldn't hold your breath for that. It looks like that's not moving forward anytime soon. So in the meantime, what is Apple going to do in the TV space? Well, Apple continues to expand Apple Music's video content, which is an interesting play. It seems like they're kind of dipping their toe in with Apple Music as they try and figure out what's going on with Apple TV. Something that happened this week is Carpool Karaoke, which is actually a skit or kind of a segment on the Late Late Show here in the States, where celebrities get in a car with the host and they sing karaoke as they video the whole thing. It had huge viral success. I think there was a segment with Michelle Obama that went really huge. They garnered, you know, big numbers on social media and sharing of the video. So it's gone very viral a number of times. Apple has supposedly secured that as an exclusive 16-episode deal for Apple Music. So they kind of spun it off out of the Late Late Show, and they're going to be producing episodes for Apple Music exclusively. So, you know, it's not clear if Apple is doing all this. You know, we've got the shows from Dr. Dre. There's a new show in the works, an apps show that's supposedly in the works. And it's not really clear, you know, if this is ultimately going to be a play for TV in general, or if it's just something to continue to sell and promote Apple Music. At this point, it looks like it's just an Apple Music thing. So, you know, what is Apple up to? What's next for Apple TV? What's this sort of broader business over time that Tim Cook is talking about? Well, you know me, I'd like to see Apple break into original programming like Netflix or Amazon, but I'm not really sure that they ever will or that they really should. Again, I think they're testing the waters with Apple Music, and if that goes really well, they could move into that, especially if they don't make any headway with the content providers. They certainly have the cash on hand to do that. I just worry it might stretch their business a little bit thin. It's not really an area of expertise for them, but it's certainly something they could do. It's a direction they could move into. But frankly, I think that, you know, the new app model on the latest generation Apple TV with channels becoming apps, I think that's working out really well for Apple, with the exception of Amazon not being on there, and I think eventually they will be. Most streaming TV providers already have an Apple TV app. You can get Netflix, Showtime, Stars, HBO, all those premium channels on there. And I think more and more folks are seeing the Apple TV as a very compelling set-top box that can do a number of other things. And I think it's those other things that Apple's going to maybe invest a little bit more in the short term to make it better. Things like voice commerce and voice-first computing. So think about turning it into an Amazon Echo-like device. If you go back and listen to my episode with Brian Romilly, there's some fascinating insight into what Apple might do in the living room with sort of a home hub. And I think the Apple TV is ripe to become that. Integrate that with home automation and HomeKit. Throw in some more gaming. They could expand the gaming capabilities, move more into augmented reality, maybe even into VR with, you know, the Apple TV. And then you have the entertainment gateway stuff on top of that, and maybe even some services gateways. So you could create a really compelling home, living room home package inside the Apple TV, really expand its capabilities and functionality. And I think it can become a pretty good breakout product. Is it ever going to be, the next big thing? I think Apple still needs something bigger like the Apple Car. But, you know, I think that may be what Tim is alluding to when he's saying we're looking at Apple TV as a broader business opportunity, especially in that voice commerce, voice first computing area, and maybe more in the home automation gaming spaces. So if Apple can expand that, throw in some services to go along with it, you know, it could be a good revenue generator moving forward. But I'd love to, I'd love to know what you think. If you have thoughts on, Apple TV or even Apple Car, shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. So I think a week can't go by where we don't talk about iPhone 7 and the loss of the headphone jack. That just seems to be the world we're living in these days. Deutsche Bank says that Apple is going to ship a Lightning to Audio dongle and not Lightning ear pods with the new iPhone 7. They also think that the iPhone 7 Plus is going to feature 3 gigabytes of RAM rather than the 2 that it currently has. And there were reported images this week of the actual adapter that might be shipping with the new iPhone. It's a short little cable, got Lightning connector on one end and then a small cylindrical adapter on the other end where the headphone jack plugs in. It very much looks like an Apple design. If the design is correct, it's really small on the headphone jack side. So there's a lot of curiosity from me on whether or not there's going to be a separate digital audio converter inside that. I think there has to be in order to use the Lightning connector, but I'm going to need to do a little bit more research. If you happen to know if that conversion can be done inside the device and then if it can send an analog signal through the Lightning connector, I don't think it can. I think it's all digital on the Lightning connector. So if that little part has a DAC in it, Apple has seriously shrunk down the digital audio converter. And I don't put it past them. It could be amazing. But to me, I like the dongle. Some people are saying, I'm going to lose it within the first week. I don't think that's going to be a problem. If you have your headphones that you like to use with your iPhone, You're just going to plug that in and you'll just leave it connected. You've basically turned your headphones into lightning headphones. And I really don't think it's going to be that big of a problem. We're also hearing more on what might be happening with the home button on the next generation iPhone. There's pretty strong rumors at this point that Apple is going to forego the clickable button and move to a touch-sensitive button that's going to have haptic feedback. So think just like the glass trackpad on the MacBooks and the MacBook Pros or the Magic trackpad, same kind of thing, but in a little small home button size. And you may also be able to detect presses and pressure like force touch. So that may open up some other gestures for that button. The other nice thing about moving to a touch sensitive button with haptic feedback is that it could be completely sealed. I've also read some reports that say the Touch ID sensor might work a little bit better if you don't have the little clicky part of the home button. So I'm starting to believe this rumor a little bit more. The home button isn't going away. I don't think we're getting that space back. It's not going to be integrated into the display. There's still going to be the Touch ID sensor ring there, but you're just not going to have the button mechanics that are built in there. And that may also allow them to make the iPhone slightly thinner. Just to do a roundup, so we're doing a thorough coverage of the iPhone 7. We'll give you the rest of the rumors for about the billionth time. The design is expected to be similar to the iPhone 6S with reduced antenna lines and a tapered camera bump bezel. It will have a larger camera lens on the iPhone 7 and the dual camera lens system on the iPhone 7 Plus only. It's expected that it may have improved stereo sound because it's getting rid of the headphone jack. It may allow Apple to put two speakers in there. Also improved waterproofing. And then there may also be a wireless charging option to go along with the headphone jack, the removal of the headphone jack, rather. So that would solve the problem where you need to use lightning headphones and maybe charge at the same time. And then there's also been these rumors of a new darker, maybe space black or space blue color replacing the space gray. So it's not going to be a new color. It's just going to replace the space gray color. And that's kind of the roundup of the iPhone 7. As far as when we'll actually be able to get our hands on one, tech blogger Evan Blass tweeted this week that the ship date for the iPhone 7 would be the week of September 12th. He said pre-orders would start on the 9th. And actually, he has been pretty good at throwing out some correct Apple rumors in the past. So if you look at your calendar, if you look at the timing of past iPhone launches, that seems like a logical launch date. You can probably circle that tentatively on your calendars as when you might be able to pick up a new iPhone 7. A few other odds and ends when it comes to the next generation of Apple products. We supposedly got our first look at an iPad Pro 12.9 version 2. There was a little leak that showed up from Chinese supplier this week via Apple Insider. It's likely really just a prototype because, as they noted in the report, it only had 12 gigabytes of storage. And we can really only speculate on this at this point on what the new features might be, but it didn't look visually really any different. But there's some obvious conclusions we can make about what might be in there. I would expect an improved processor, an Apple A10X maybe, a better camera system. Expect Apple to bring the True Tone display of the smaller iPad Pro 9.7 to the 12.9-inch model. And then some people have speculated that it may possibly have 3D touch, although I think that's unlikely. Bringing that to a larger screen, I think, is going to pose many more challenges, and I don't think Apple's quite ready to tackle that just yet. And I'm just not sure also how well 3D touch would work on a 12.9-inch display. I'm not sure the benefits would all be there. But supposedly, iPad Pro 12.9 is in the works. I think we're going to see a full update of almost all of Apple's hardware products sometime in the fall. And related to that, there are supply chain rumors saying that Apple Watch 2 could be coming in the September-October timeframe. I would expect it to be a relatively minor update, maybe faster processor, better battery life, maybe some better sensor capabilities in there. We have had some rumors that it may add GPS and maybe even cellular capabilities, so it wouldn't be tied to an iPhone, which would be very nice. I think those features will be in there if Apple can figure out the battery life issues. I think battery life is going to be a priority. Battery life and speed is going to be a priority for the next generation Apple Watch. And then everything else is just really going to be gravy. And then as far as how sales are going, IDC thinks that Apple Watch sales right now have dropped to about 1.6 million units. That was for the June quarter. That's down 2 million units from 3.6 million units in the same quarter a year ago. So sales are slumping. Apple still has the largest share of the smartwatch market, but I wouldn't expect a new Apple Watch and Apple Watch 2 to do a whole lot to bump those numbers up. I think it's going to be slow and steady growth for the Apple Watch. It's not a breakout hit, definitely not a flop, but I don't think it's going to be, you know, huge in terms of Apple's bottom line moving forward, but do expect an updated Apple Watch probably this fall. All right, let's address the Pokemon in the room, right? Okay, we're not spending a lot of time on this, but it has to be said, Pokemon Go, the app came out, it's huge. Nintendo says they've seen, or I think it's Niantic, actually, the company that developed the app for Nintendo. They're seeing 26 million daily active users in the U.S. as of July 15th. That makes it the biggest mobile game launch in U.S. history, beating out even Candy Crush Saga. It is tapering off now, though, a little bit. Those daily active user numbers are starting to taper off, and I expect that the fad of Pokemon Go, all the fad users, the guys like me who jumped on board just to try it out, just to see what it's all about, we're going to drop off pretty quickly. I don't expect to be playing Pokemon Go every day, although I have had some fun playing it. I have to admit, I continue to open the app once in a while and look around for those Pokemon, but I'm not obsessed with catching them all or anything. And I think there's a lot of us like that out there. So I think that's going to continue to factor in the numbers. But why are we talking about this? Why is this so important? Well, some analysts think that Apple could generate an additional $3 billion in revenue just from the in-app purchase revenue on Pokemon Go. I think they're being a little bit overly optimistic, again, because I think they're basing their numbers off this huge daily active users that I think is going to drop off pretty quickly. But even if they were able to generate a third of that amount, $1 billion in revenue from in-app purchases on a single game for Apple, that's nothing to sneeze at. So that's a pretty big impact. And then the only other thing I want to mention on this is there were a lot of reports out there saying that Nintendo was going to make a ton of money from Pokemon Go. They even saw their stock price go up a little bit. It got adjusted, though, when Nintendo came out and pointed out how the whole thing is sort of set up. So Pokemon Go is actually a collaboration of four companies: Nintendo, the Google spinoff Niantic, Google, and the Pokemon Company. And in case you're wondering, what is the Pokemon Company? The Pokemon Company is actually the company that maintains the intellectual property trademarks and trademarks and things for Pokemon for Nintendo and And Nintendo only holds about one third of that company. So there's a lot of other companies involved that are going to make a lot more money than Nintendo off this whole Pokemon thing. And Nintendo's probably kicking themselves a little bit for this, but they'll do all right, but just not as well as many of the reports are making them out to sort of be. You know, Pokemon Go is not going to save Nintendo as a company. They're going to have to still continue to do all the other things that they've been doing. And we know they've been struggling a little bit. So I don't know. How do you like Pokemon Go? Are you playing? Like I said, I've enjoyed it. It's fun to play, but I'm not totally obsessed like the rest of the world seems to be at the moment. And that's fine. Again, I think it's going to fade out a month from now. We're not going to hear very little about Pokemon Go, I think. Something we are going to be hearing about a little bit more in the next month is the Olympics. The Olympics are coming. They're going to be starting in Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. And if you're going to the Olympics, you can pick up a special edition Apple Watch. They're only going to be available for purchase at Rio de Janeiro's Village Mall Apple Store, but they're going to have a number of 14 different versions of a nylon woven band exclusive for the Olympics in the colors of the flags of 14 nations: Australia, Brazil, Canada, China, France, Germany, Great Britain, Japan, Jamaica, Mexico, the Netherlands, New Zealand, South Africa, and the U.S. The straps are going to be the standard nylon strap price, U.S. $49. And I think they look great. There's some great options in there. I still would love to get my hands on the special edition one Apple did for Pride Day in San Francisco. I think those were given out only to employees, but that was a rainbow colored band that looks awesome. And I would love to have one of those. I also like the UK band, the British band, and the Chinese band for the Olympics. There were some pictures that surfaced online of all these different brands. I think the Mexico one looks pretty nice too, as well as US. I mean, go USA, but some of those other countries I think got a little better look when it comes to the Apple Watch band. But take a look, see what you think. New Apple Watch bands, if you're going to the Olympics, you can maybe pick one of those up. And then finally in the news for this week, DigiTimes is reporting that Apple will adopt the USB Type-C ports for what they're saying is their next MacBook Air. Yeah, you know, if you're scratching your head right now, I was doing the same thing when I saw this report. I think it seems highly unlikely because I think the MacBook Air is actually destined for the chopping block. I don't think Apple's going to do another version of the MacBook Air. Now, that said, I do expect that Apple will be updating the MacBook Pro lineup this fall, and I think it will have USB-C ports. The question is, will it have only USB-C ports? And I think probably not. I think, at least for this first version, Apple's likely to have a combo of USB-C and Thunderbolt, even though the USB-C port does support Thunderbolt 3 over the USB-C connector. I think Apple's still going to put it in there for legacy reasons because it's a pro system. They're not going to want everybody to have to do adapters, say, for their mini display port displays and things like that. So I think they're going to leave it in there, at least for this first generation model. This is the model that will also likely have the OLED touch bar that's going to replace the function keys and may also have Touch ID. I'm a little bit 50-50 on the Touch ID sensor, but the fact that Apple added Apple Pay support in Safari for Mac OS Sierra, I think they're going to want to get Touch ID into all of their products, including their notebooks. And I would expect that we may even see Touch ID make its way to the Magic Trackpad or maybe the keyboard, the Apple keyboard, wireless keyboard, something like that. So expect to see Touch ID everywhere. And definitely there should be a refresh to the MacBook Pro line. Again, I'm expecting to see that in the fall. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Moving on to some of your feedback. You all know that I am fanatic about backups and archiving. And so when Fred sent in this question, I thought, you know, this is right up my alley, Fred. So thanks for sending it in. He wanted to know, how do I take my iMovie projects? I've got some iMovie projects. They're on my local hard drive. How do I take those, move them off? I want to archive them off onto an external disk. And just so everybody knows, I'm going to be covering the instructions for iMovie 10 and later. So if you have iMovie 2011, which is iMovie version 9, I think, the instructions are similar, but they're going to be a little bit different. And when you're dealing with iMovie, especially iMovie 10, when you open it up, the first thing that you need to understand to kind of understand how the archiving of projects works is the different kinds of elements that you work with in iMovie 10. So you have your events, which is going to be all of the clips and things that you import into iMovie. Those are all categorized under the Events tab. And then you have the actual projects, the movies, the edits and things that you're working on. That's going to be where you're going to assemble your clips. You're going to put together your music, and you're going to do all that sort of stuff. All that stuff is encompassed inside your project, and the clips that are inside your project reference the imported movies that you're going to have in your events. So they kind of go hand in hand. Projects are the movie projects that you import your event clips into when you're editing. Now, prior to iMovie 10, events and projects were stored in separate folders. So if you went into the Finder and you looked at where those things were stored, you would see an iMovie events folder and an iMovie projects folder. But starting with iMovie 10, Everything is now just in a single library. So it works more like iPhoto or the Photos application, where you have your events and your projects all inside this single file. And you really can't go in there and really mess with anything. And I think this is one of the things that confuses people a little bit. And that may be something that's throwing you off a little bit, Fred, when it comes to, you know, how do I move this stuff out and how do I archive it? So you kind of need to think about it in the same way that you would think about your photos. You're going to go into the Photos app to manage that, to export out, to do your archiving and things like that. Same kind of thing in iMovie. So what you're going to do if you want to move an event or project off onto an external drive inside iMovie is you're going to first open up iMovie. And then for an event, you're going to click on the Media tab. And in the Libraries sidebar, you're going to see a list of any iMovie libraries you have loaded. Now, typically, if you have a default installation, there's likely to be only one of these, and it's going to be the default library. It's probably going to be called iMovie Library, and it typically would be stored inside your home folder in your user folder inside the Movies folder. So you would see something like iMovie Library, and I think, I'm trying to remember what it's called. I'm going to look in my Movies folder. The extension is .iMovie Library. So it will say iMovie Library .iMovie Library, just like photos.photos library for your photos. And that's where all your content is stored locally by default. And you can create new libraries. And this is kind of the key. If you want to archive your stuff off, the first thing you do is you actually create a new library and you put that on the external drive, wherever you want to move that to. And you do that inside the iMovie application. And you can really set the location of your library to any drive, any connected drive, removable drive if you wanted to use a USB storage drive. So what you do is in iMovie, you're going to go to File, Open Library, and you're going to choose New. And you're going to give it a name, maybe something like iMovie Archive dot iMovie Library. It'll add the extension itself, so you don't have to add that. So just type something like iMovie Archive, or I think I called mine iMovie External, so that I could, you know, tell, okay, that's the library that's on the external drive. Name it whatever you need to so that you can easily recall it, and then set its location to be on your external drive or wherever you want to archive your movies to. So maybe to a Drobo, whatever it might be. And then after you do that, when you're back in iMovie in your sidebar, you're going to see that listed. And it will very likely have a default event set up, which is usually the current date that you added the new library. And you can create additional events. Events are just kind of like folders. There's just a way to organize the clips that you import so that you can kind of have them all in a single area. And more likely than not, what you're going to be wanting to be moving from your internal drive to the external drive is an event. So once you have the two libraries set up, your internal library and your external library, you have kind of two options for moving that event media. You can either copy it so that you have a copy on your internal drive and on your external drive, or you can actually move it. In your case, because you're archiving, you probably want to do the move, but I'm going to cover both methods. So to copy, it's very simple. You just drag the event or media from one library to the other, and it will just make a copy of it. And you'll notice when you're dragging, you'll see the little green plus symbol indicating that you're making a copy. If you'd prefer to move it rather than copy it, just hold down the command key as you're dragging, and you'll notice that little green plus symbol will go away. And when you drop the event or media, it will actually be moved instead of copied. And that's it. That's all you have to do to move it from your internal drive to the external drive. Again, the key is make sure you're doing this all inside the iMovie application itself. And as I said, you've got two things. You've got your events, which are your clips, or your media events, all of your movie clips. So you want to move those. And then you very likely also have your projects. And moving projects is a little bit different, but it's a very similar concept. And inside your projects, what you're going to have is you're going to have your project files, you're going to have all of your media, the clips that you've actually edited out. And I think they're actually really just references back to the original clips. And as you're moving and archiving stuff within iMovie, it's updating all of the paths in the background. So you really don't have to worry about it too much as long as you follow this methodology for moving your iMovie projects and files to the external drive. So For moving projects, you're going to click on the Projects tab in iMovie, and then you kind of get this little grid view. And at the top of the grid view, you'll see all your projects in a grid. And then at the top of this grid view, there's a little drop down next to the search box, and it probably says something like All Projects. If you click on that and you look at the drop down, you'll notice you can switch between various views. And a couple of those views, depending upon how many iMovie libraries you have, are going to be the various iMovie libraries. So you can look at your local library, or you can look at this new iMovie archive library, and you can see just the projects that are in that library. And that's going to help you visualize, you know, where these projects are in terms of location. Are they on your internal drive, or are they on your external drive? So you can switch back and forth between them. So when you're in the main view, or when you're in the local view, you can hover over one of your projects in that little grid, and you'll see a little ellipses icon. It's a little circle with a dot, dot, dot in it. And if you click on that, then you'll see the options to copy to library or move to library. And that's how you copy or move your project files to another library. So you select that. You'll see a list of the available libraries under either the copy or the move option. And then you can simply just move or copy your projects to another iMovie library. And when you move or copy a project, it's also going to move or copy all of the event files that are needed for that project. So it all kind of come over together, again, as long as you're doing it all inside iMovie. And that's pretty much it. That's how you can move and archive your iMovie projects. A few other tips: when you create a new event, you may want to name it before importing your clips into it. So that's in the Media tab. Just to help keep things organized. So it's sort of like creating a folder before you actually move all the files into it. That's something I like to do just so that I can keep my stuff organized. You're more than welcome to just store everything at the top level of the library. But for me personally, I think it gets a little bit cluttered. And then also, when you're importing your movie clips, pay attention to the import to setting at the top of the import window. It's a little drop down. And make sure that it's set to the correct library and event location that you want all of the clips that you're importing to go into. I think by default, it just goes on to the main library on the internal drive. And that may or may not be exactly what you want. I actually prefer to have everything go directly into my external drive. And then I back up all of that content to my Drobo using a ChronoSync task, and then I make sure that all of my iMovie projects and events are always backed up, as well as having sort of an archive of them. So that's kind of how I handle it. I hope that helps explain everything. If something wasn't clear, if you have any questions and want to follow up with me, just shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. Another thing that came up this week was a question from Terry. Well, actually, it was more of a request for an explanation. Terry asked me to talk about some of the confusion that can ensue when you're trying to share media between your iTunes library on your Mac and the music application and potentially the video application in iOS. And the first thing that I want to talk about is, and what I want to get to is, we're specifically talking about home sharing. So sharing over your local area network. But there are a couple of different kinds of sharing that could come into play here that I just want to point out. So we have things like Apple Music, which technically, I guess, it's not really sharing. It's more like a streaming service, right? It's cloud music. So I sign up for Apple Music and I have access to the entire library of Apple Music that Apple has in the cloud, and I can stream that to my devices. So not really sharing, but thing is Apple Music has a component to it called iCloud Music Library. And so if you're using iCloud Music Library as part of Apple Music, you can have some of the music that's on your Mac uploaded to your iCloud Music Library and made available. So the stuff that isn't matched, the stuff that isn't in Apple's music library, still gets uploaded and is still accessible from all of your devices, streaming or downloading. So that's kind of a form of sharing, but it's really kind of more like syncing through Apple's iCloud Music Library. And iTunes Match is another service that Apple offers, does the matching, allows you to get at your music library from anywhere on all of your iOS devices, similar to the iCloud Music Library portion of Apple Music. Again, that's a kind of sharing, but that's really not what we're talking about here. What Terry was talking about is the confusion over something called home sharing, which all happens on your local area network. So now that we have that clear, what is home sharing? How does it work? And how do I turn it on? And how do I use it is kind of the question here. Home sharing is something that you can enable on iTunes on a Mac, and then it will make that library available to iOS devices, to your Apple TV, or to other Macs that are also logged in to the same home sharing account. And basically, it's a way to kind of remotely see the entire library of stuff on a Mac, on iTunes, on the local area network. And the way you enable it is you need to have, of course, an iTunes account, an Apple ID. And then in iTunes, what you do is you go into the iTunes menu under home sharing, and then there's an option to turn on home sharing. And then you simply log in with your iTunes Apple ID. And then at that point, home sharing is turned on and enabled for iTunes on that Mac. And then to access that music remotely over the local area network, all you have to do is on an iOS device, an iPhone, an iPad, an iPod Touch, you go into settings under music, into home sharing, and again, you sign in. Now, the key is you want to use the exact same iTunes Apple ID. And here's a pro tip. I don't know that this is 100% necessary, but for me, it seems to eliminate some of the bugs and issues with home sharing. Make sure that the email address you use to sign in on your iOS device is exactly the same email address you used for home sharing on your Mac. So if you used an @me.com address, then use that on every device that you want to log into home sharing with. Even if you have, you know, an old @mac.com email address that works the same as your @me, just make sure when it comes to home sharing, you're always using exactly the same email address. Shouldn't make a difference, but it actually does. I've run into problems where I was using, say, iCloud.com on my device, but my Mac was logged in iTunes to home sharing with @me.com. And things weren't syncing up. I was having issues and it wasn't working. It's a little pro tip for you there. But once you've turned on home sharing, you also probably want to go into the iTunes library and set a name for it, something unique so that when you're looking for your music on home sharing, you recognize it on your home network. So for that, go into iTunes again on the Mac, go into Preferences under General, and you'll see you can set the library name. Now, another little security tip for you, it's generally not advised that you use your first and last name, or even just your first name, as your library name in iTunes. And the reason for that is, if you're out at a public place, you're using public Wi-Fi, you're on that network, and somebody could go into iTunes, and they could see that information, and they could glean, you know, maybe your name, first and last name, and they could maybe do that to do a little, you know, spoofing on you to try and maybe do some identity theft or some other things. So you have to be really careful. You don't want your name being broadcast out over a network. And if you have home sharing turned on, that is being broadcast out. So when you set up your iTunes library name, make it something unique, maybe something clever, something that you're going to recognize as your iTunes library name, but don't use your, you know, first and last, actual real first and last name. Once you have all this enabled, how do you access your shared, home shared media on your device? Well, it's pretty simple. Again, in iTunes on the Mac, you have to have iTunes open and home sharing needs to be turned on. Your device and your Mac need to be on the same Wi-Fi network or the same LAN connection. So you need to make sure you're on the same local area network. And then what you're going to do is you're going to go into the music app on your iOS device. You're going to tap on My Music. And then you want to tap on the little drop down where it says artist or album or genre, whatever it might be, that little drop down at the top of where your music is listed. And as long as home sharing is turned on and your Mac and your device are on the same network and iTunes is open and running, what you should see in that dropdown at the bottom is an option for home sharing. So then you click on that, and that'll bring up a list of libraries. What you'll see very likely is your local library on your device. So that'll be the name of your device. And then under that, you should see the iTunes library listed, the thing that you set up earlier when you set up that iTunes library name. So you'll see that listed. You should be able to pick that. And then it will take a minute or two. It will load up all of the media that's in your iTunes library, or actually just, it's not really loading the media, I guess. It's loading a list of all of your music file names, and not file names, but the music titles, the albums, the videos, the music, the home videos, the TV shows, everything that you have in that local iTunes library, and it's displaying it within the music app on your iOS device. So you'll be able to see all of that stuff, and you'll be able to access it and play it directly on your device. And it's essentially streaming over your local area network to that device. You're not actually downloading anything. It's giving you a remote view and remote control of that library and allowing you to play that stuff back. And for music, you'll see all that stuff in the music app. It pretty much works the same way for videos from the video app. And so video, movies, TV shows, all those things you're going to access from videos. Same kind of thing. You open up the videos application. You tap on the shared button. And note that the shared button is only going to appear there if you have iTunes running, home sharing is enabled, and both the Mac and the device are on the same local area network. Tap on that. You'll choose your local iTunes library. And then you will browse and play. You know, it'll take a little minute to load up, and then you'll be able to browse and play any movies or TV shows from iTunes right onto your device. And once again, Apple TV also has support for home sharing, and it works in a very similar way. And that should be it. That should be as simple as it gets. But as Terry noted in his email, sometimes home sharing libraries mess up. The most common error that I think you will see is you go to access that shared library, it starts loading, it starts showing you a little progress wheel, it gets about a quarter of the way, and then just dies. It just stops. Nothing ever loads. And it just sits there forever, and you get very frustrated, not knowing what's going on, you think it's broken, and you ultimately give up and you go watch something on Netflix. At least that's my experience. If you see that happen, what I found is the easiest way to get it fixed, the way I most often fix that issue is simply by, on my device, I go in and I log out of home sharing. So go into settings, go into general, go into music or video. It doesn't really matter because you can actually enable home sharing from either place. But you go in there and just under the home sharing section, log out and then log back in. And then go back to the music app or the video app and try to load home sharing again. And it usually, you know, 99% of the time for me, loads right up. I don't have that problem where it stalls out. The other error that you might see, which again, Terry noted in his email, is you are browsing through your music library via home sharing. You go to click on a music file to listen to it, and up pops an error message, quote, "You do not have permission to access the required resource." And you're thinking, wait a minute, it's in my iTunes library. My iTunes library is authenticated. I do have permission for that. I think what can happen, and I'm not 100% sure on this, but I think what's going on here is if you somehow try to access a music file that still has FairPlay DRM on it, you know, back when Apple DRM'd the purchased music you had on iTunes, and that music was maybe purchased under a different account that doesn't match the one that you're using for home sharing, I think is when you might see that error message. And this could even happen if the files were authorized to play with this, again, with the same iTunes account, but it was a different email. So maybe you've set up home sharing with your @me.com account, but the DRM files in your iTunes library were registered under your @mac.com account. I think even just that little mismatch can cause a problem with some of the playback. You know, it's just because the studios were so, or the music labels were so paranoid about music piracy that Apple had to build all these kind of controls and safeguards into iTunes. And I think it causes these kinds of problems. But again, that's just my theory on this. If anybody else knows why you might see that error message, and if it's different from what I'm thinking, please shoot us an email, maccast@gmail.com. But Terry, I hope that kind of helps clear up how sharing between iTunes and the music app on iOS devices works. All right, lastly for today, I have a great thing of the moment for you this week. For those of you who don't know, earlier in the month, I was actually speaking at the MacStock Expo in MacStock, Illinois. It was a great event. If you heard the last MacCast, we kind of recapped things and talked a little bit about how that went. I gave a talk on STEAM and STEAM education, or using Apple products for STEAM education. That's science, technology, engineering, art, and math teaching. And one of the products that I actually covered in my talk was a cool app called Floors from PixelPress. And I'll have a link to this in the show notes at maccast.com. But what this is this is kind of a cool app and system that basically lets you draw out your own side-scrolling video games on graph paper. So they give you a sheet of graph paper, they give you some symbols and things that you draw on that graph paper, and you basically design out levels of a 2D side-scrolling game all on paper, paper and pencil. And then what you do after you've set that up is you can actually take their app, the Floors app, and your iPad, and you use the camera to scan in the levels that you've drawn out on paper, and it converts them right on the iPad into a playable game. And then once it's on the iPad, you can actually test and tweak the gameplay, you know, make sure you didn't build a platform that was too high to jump onto, or a gap that's too hard, you know, too far to jump across. And then you can tweak and adjust the gameplay and the settings. And then you can do things like add in skins and themes, expand out your story. They actually even have an Adventure Time themed version of the system. So if you were into the Cartoon Network show Adventure Time, there's a whole system that works just like Floors. And you basically build your own video game, which is really cool. You're building your own, I don't know, 2D side-scroller iPad video game using the system. And there's this cool just physical element, and you can kind of teach kids about the design process, you know, the iterative design process of, you know, sketching something out first and then kind of converting that into digital form and then tweaking it and play testing it and that whole cycle. So it is a really great way to kind of learn the whole concept of game development. Well, the same company, PixelPress, actually just came out with a new project called Bloxels. It's a whole new system called Bloxels. And the idea behind this is it's similar. You're going to design and build your own side-scrolling video game. But with Bloxels, you develop all of the game elements using this 13 by 13 plastic grid, kind of like a tray with little square holes, basically Bloxel holes. Think of them like pixels. And then you get a whole series of small colored blocks that you drop into that grid. And you use the blocks to basically design a 13-bit elements. And you can design all of the elements of your games, everything from backgrounds to characters to obstacles to rewards. And you do it with these physical elements, these little Bloxels that you put into this grid. And then once again, you use the app, the Bloxels app, Bloxels Designer app, and the iPad or iPhone camera to actually scan them in. And so it captures that and it actually turns it into your game. And then once you have it on the iPad, you can again fine-tune things. You can add all of the things that you develop into your game design and into your levels. And you even build each room of your game with the Bloxels grid. And the way it works is different colored Bloxels represent the different parts of your level. So for example, the little green blocks represent your terrain, purple blocks are enemies, red blocks are hazards, The blue blocks are water. So if you want to make a little water pit that you have to jump over or a waterfall, you would put a bunch of blue blocks into your room. And a game can have up to 169 rooms, basically 13 by 13. Everything is built off of, you know, based off this 13 by 13 grid with bloxels. And it is a whole lot of fun. You even get to design your characters with these bloxels, and then you animate them. You set up animations for walking and jumping, and you can either do that in the app, you know, do those tweaks in the app, or you can actually do that with the physical bloxels themselves. And you can build animations for other game elements. So say you want to have a spinning coin that, you know, someone has to collect, or maybe you want to have water that's really moving in your terrain or your background. You can build all of that with the bloxels. And then once you've built out your game, you can upload it, you can share your finished game, your characters, your elements, and you can even download ones that other people have created to use in your own games. There's really infinite possibilities. It is a ton of fun, and it's not too expensive. The Bloxels starter kit is just $49.95, and the app is totally free. And it's even possible to build everything with just the app. So you could go in and just build your whole game using the virtual tools that are built into the app. And that'd be great if you just wanted to check it out, if you're curious after hearing this, if you want to check out the system. But I would really encourage you to buy the Bloxels kit, because I think that's what really makes it fun. It's the idea of taking something physical that you build with your hands, that you kind of prototype out using these little blocks, and then turning that into the actual digital playable thing. That something about the whole process to me is just really, really appealing. So it's called Bloxels, B-L-O-X-E-L-S, and you can get it at bloxelsbuilder.com to check it all out. Again, the company is Pixel Press. They have a website at projectpixelpress.com, and that is my thing of the moment for this week. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Thanks for hanging out with me again. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen for iOS and PDF Pen Scan Plus. You can get more information and details on everything that Smile makes over at smilesoftware.com. And Gazelle. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cacheFly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media, and they are at backbeatmedia.com. If you have a comment for me, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send me audio comments or emails to maccast@gmail.com. If you'd prefer, you can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or you can check out our Google Plus community. You can find that at google.com/plusMacCast, and that's the plus symbol. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.